So we might get going. Thanks very much for coming along tonight and welcome. My great pleasure to introduce a man who needs no introduction, I think, for our members, our former CEO John Moroney, and now with the IAIS, and we're looking forward to hearing from you tonight, John. Thanks for coming all the way from Switzerland just to talk to us.
Welcome. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As Melinda said, it's time I come from Switzerland just to talk to such a distinguished group, but it's my pleasure to do so, and I think Bill's in the audience somewhere, and I believe he's planning to back up for the encore session in Brisbane, so I certainly look forward to continuing these discussions beyond, and it was also very good of Kevin Rudd to call the election sort of while I was here, and that's prompted a lot of interesting discussion on many, many issues, and one of my colleagues pointed out that he collected this brochure from the Citizens Electoral Council of Australia complaining about the various things that the Financial Stability Board is doing, including installing Jim Murphy as a onto the Kevin Rudd staff. So it's good to see that there's so much interest in what's going on in Bath and other parts. But I'll leave that aside for the moment and turn to the main purpose of what I'm here to do is cover the issue of the identification and supervision of globally systemically important insurers, or GSIs, we call them in Basel. This is essentially the story of what I've been doing over there for the last 2 or 3 years. Many people wondered how I could leave such a wonderful place like Sydney, Australia, the Institute of Actuaries, and Sydney is the best city in the world, Australia's the best country in the world. But it's not the only city and country in the world. There are plenty over there, and it was great to see Melinda step into the role in such good hands and doing a wonderful job. But let me turn to the headlines of what's on here. It's not working. What's working when I press the floor?
Maybe
we've
just run out of that tree.
There we go. Sorry, it was just my two big thumbs. So the topics I'll cover was show up on the screen here. Just a little bit of the headline news, and this was all subject to what was decided by the Financial Stability Board and the G20 last month. A bit of background about the organisation I now work for, which is the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, and a lot of my role is dealing with the Financial Stability Board, both of which are hosted by the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, and I assure you there'll be many more acronyms before the end of the night. We've already done the GSIs one, so I'll tell about how we actually found them. A little bit about what is proposed to try to keep them better regulated, shall we say, from our perspective, including such things as a systemic risk management plan, and finally just a little bit on the broader issue of the whole macroprudential policy and surveillance, which is looking right across the whole system regionally, globally. So that's the map of what's to be covered. So until the 18th of July, until the 18th of July, this was one of the most secret lists of information. The nine firms that the Financial Stability Board, in consultation with ourselves, designated as the first cohort of globally systemic insurers. I won't read through the names there, but I imagine most of those are familiar to the audience. The ones that are perhaps a little unfamiliar are the third one, Generali, is certainly a very major player in Italy and parts of Europe. And the third last one, Pigang, is a very rapidly growing insurer out of China. And many people had a heads up on that one when it purchased Lloyd's last month, until I read the fine print and found out it had purchased the building and not the business. But we'll have to wait and see what's purchased next year. So some of the major statements which were reported, this is one from the G20 meeting of finance ministers and central banks, saying they supported what we had been doing with the FSB to finalise this package, and they welcomed the publication of the initial list, and they welcome our plans to develop a simple group-wide capital requirement to be finalised by the time they have the next G20 summit in 2014. In Brisbane, they didn't say, but that's where it will be. And that will serve as a foundation for high loss absorbency requirements, which we'll turn to later on. And the other things the Financial Stability Board said when they endorsed what we've been working on, that is a foundation for high loss absorbency. They want to develop, they call it a straightforward backstop capital requirements. And if you want to know what that means, you'll just have to watch as we work on developing and defining what that means over the next 12 months or so. And they also want us to build on this and develop a high loss absorbency rules by the end of 2015, and they will apply from 2019. So these timeframes might seem like a long time out, but if anyone here has been watching development of international insurance accounting standards, I think that's 15 years in work in progress. Solvency II, I think, is now over 10 years work in progress, and they're still struggling. So there are areas that you can't say you're going to fix them in 6, 12 or 18 months. And we think these timeframes are reasonable. They also tie in what's happened with the globally systemically important banks. And the next quote from the official words were, this is a broader one of not just focused on GSIs, but to add another acronym, IAIG, you'll see in the middle of the page, Internationally Active Insurance Groups. This is saying they want us to develop a comprehensive group-wide regulatory and supervisory framework, including a quantitative capital standard, which is pretty much like what the banks have had for 5-10 years, depending how long you look back at the Basel I, Basel II, Basel III frameworks, and they want us to agree when and how to do that by the end of this year. So my colleagues back in Basel are working very hard on trying to turn that request into reality. So that's the quick big picture. This is the sort of work that... Please.
Excuse us. Locked out.
So that's the background to the request from the G20 and the FSB, and that essentially is, in a sense, driving the timeframes we're working on and giving legitimacy to the work we're doing. Moving on to the rest of the topics, as I said, I'll give a bit of background about the two organisations for those that are unfamiliar with the way the global financial regulatory system works. And this starts with looking at the IS activities. We, as an organisation, have been around for about 15 years, and when we were first set up, it wasn't quite clear what the role would be. It was essentially modelled somewhat on the Basel Committee for Banking Supervision, but only quite loosely. So the big circle there in the middle, the standard setting, is the key thing we do, and that's now enshrined in essentially edicts from the G20 and the Financial Stability Board, saying that there's a number of global standard-setting bodies in the financial sector, so we look after insurance standards, the Basel Committee looks after the banking, IOSCO looks after securities, there are a number of others, but they're the three main ones that we interact with. On the top side, the financial stability is the newest of our areas, and that's where I focus and specialise on, and that really came out of the financial crisis, where there was essentially a conclusion that it was not enough just to look at individual firms, particularly on the banking side, but also on other sectors. You needed to look at just the impact on the system rather than just the firms. And the bottom right-hand side there, I might even have a project anyway. Yes, the standard implementation assessment. So we've now got a group of our staff and committees that are focused on helping our members. We've got members in 140 countries, almost 200 members. Of course, the US is state-based, so they've got 56 insurance supervisors in the US. We're hoping that that'll extend. We've got one federal representative of the US Treasury who became a member a couple of years ago out of the creation of the Federal Insurance Office by the Dodd-Frank Act. So that group there is designed to both assist in implementation and check that there has been successful implementation and monitoring of the rules, etc. And external relations, increasingly there's a lot of focus not just from our members on what we're doing, but on the broader regulatory system, etc. That's on the structure side. I'll skip through this one pretty quickly. This is the internal workings. So again, that's my area of activity. I'll come to this group on the macro-prudential surveillance side. this specialist group has now been set up as a couple of separate workings, but again, you can see there's quite a bit of internal workings. We've got a small team in Basel, 25 staff. Our members are, as I said, hundreds of, or 190 members around the world. We have most of our meetings in Basel, but lots sort of scattered around there. And most of the work gets done at meetings, but we try to get a lot done through conference calls, web facilities, etc. Perhaps of more interest is the global structure. Again, see, we're one of the three global standard setters with the other two. Financial Stability Board is more at the macro side, looking right across the line. There's also a joint forum which essentially brings these three groups together, and that preceded the creation of the Financial Stability Board, and there's a coordination group that sort of sits on top of that, which is our chairman and chief executive working with the chairs and chief executives of the other two. And we also interact a lot with the International Accounting Standards Board. The OECD has got interest in insurance and pensions, so it's a it's an increasing interesting interaction, and there's been a shift from what was previously just the micro-prudential focus on the firms to the macro-prudential side of looking more broadly, and not just from these groups, but also from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have got quite a lot of interest in trying to ensure that this system works in a way of keeping system stable, firms stable. And the Financial Stability Board is probably the one of most relevance in looking at the whole projects on GCIPs and GSIs. It's the one with the G20 mandate that has been working for the last 3 or 4 years on this part of the project. It's a key part, but not the only part of what they do. So just a little bit of information about them. I'll skip through this pretty quickly, but happy to come back and deal with more questions on that. So it was originally set up after the Asian financial crisis, but then relaunched as a board with an expanded membership and mandate after the global financial crisis. It's currently chaired by Mark Carney, who took on the role of Governor of the Bank of England last month, and it's hosted by the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, like ourselves. In fact, they picked up the corporate the legal entity model that the IAS has run with the last 15 years as their sort of model that fits within the Swiss legal system quite nicely. The membership comprises those listed there, a mixture of ministries for finance, central banks, supervisors. We're a member in our own right, and we're members on most of their key committees, etc. Again, some extra acronyms down the bottom. The ECB, the European Central Bank, is becoming a much more significant player in direct regulation of most of the big banks in Europe over the next year or two. The European Commission plays a key role in that as well. You've got the CGFS, the Committee for the Global Financial System, which does a macro-prudential monitoring role. So there's lots of different groups at the global and regional level that are involved in trying to make these things work better. And then some of the key things that the FSB does in terms of looking at vulnerabilities. So I've got one of my staff that goes along to their assessment group for vulnerabilities, which is meeting several times a year, trying to look at where's the next explosion in the financial system likely to come from. Certainly long-term low interest rates and the impact on the insurance and pension industries is quite a key concern. The second point there on policy development, that's now chaired by Dan Tarullo, who's one of the directors on the board of the Federal Reserve Board. Previously it was Lord Adair Turner from the Financial Services Authority. So there's some very senior key people that are driving these groups for significant regulatory reform. And ending the Too Big to Fail project is probably the one of the most high-profile ones. So there's three arms to that, as shown in there. The credible resolution regime. Paul Tucker, who's a deputy governor of the Bank of England, has been driving that. And it's all about making sure that big firms, if they do fail, can fail in a way that doesn't bring the system down. So you look at what happened with Lehman, what would have happened with AIG, what could have happened with a number of other major players if governments and central banks and treasuries hadn't stepped in and literally pumped trillions of dollars of capital and liquidity into the system back in 2008, 2009. So there's now a whole major system, and I'll point to some of the interesting things that in their later stage of consultation, which was released on Monday this week, in terms of how do you actually go about putting in place the legal structures, the regulatory structures, the cooperation structures, cross-sector, cross-border. And I must say, it's one of the most complex issues that I've sort of had visibility on in just how this would work. And the middle one, the high loss absorbent thing, this is basically on the assumption if you want the system to be safer, make the biggest and most complex and most risky players hold more capital on the basis that should reduce their probability of default, their risk of failing, and it probably also would help reduce the impact of failing. That's the underlying theory of the whole push for, particularly on the bank side, but also now on the GSI side, for more capital to be held by those firms which are regarded as most likely to cause a big negative impact to the system if they failed. And the third area is more intense supervision, which I'll turn to by some examples later on. And just some of the recent activities. So the G-SIBs have been, there's two lists of globally systemically important banks have been published, so that's all well known. The rating agencies look at those and have quite a clear view that by being on those lists there is an actual potential advantage for them in fundraising, etc. They don't believe the same for the GSIs. The work there, that's where we've sort of stepped in last month in coming up the names. There's still work going on for the non-banks, non-insurers down here by IOSCO and the Financial Stability Board itself. So this is an ongoing process of getting across sectors. We don't know how many there'll be in the other areas and how it'll extend over time, but it's a quite extensive coordinated process across the sectors. And as part of the overall priorities from the FSB is shown there, of trying to get the institutions more resilient. One of the biggest areas of the problem is the third one shown there, the problems in the over-the-counter derivatives market. And for those that are unfamiliar with that, it might sound a fairly esoteric and sort of why are you worried about that sort of thing, but it was an enormous contributor to the turbulence in the financial system back in 2008-2009, and the fundamentals of that system haven't changed a lot. They are trying to put in place a number of things to do with it, but it's a major project and one that Mark Carney has personally been very involved in trying to push the reforms along. And there's a whole area of shadow banking and other things I'm not going to spend time talking today, but if you want to read the documents that are up there on the FSB's website. Moving to our role in it, the first thing I did when I got involved in the financial stability activities back in 2010 was help sort of publish some basic position statements of where the IS saw this from a point of view of the insurance sector. Many insurers, their associations, and quite a few supervisors were saying, look, what's happening in the banking world is really irrelevant for the insurance world, that it is really just a banking issue. And that probably would have been accepted, except you had the AIG example, where it cost, in the short term, US taxpayers $182 billion to bail out that what was primarily a liquidity issue rather than a solvency issue. But any organisation that essentially gets on the cliff of failure and taxpayers have to contribute $182 billion, yes, they got their money back, and they got back more than $20 billion. So it was actually a positive investment for the taxpayers, that's great, but it did show that this wasn't an issue just restricted to the banking sector. And that's driven the political thinking and the FSB thinking. And so we've looked at issues and we've focused very much on the differences between traditional insurance and banking. There's a different time dimension. And you know, we're happy to say, look, there's little evidence of traditional insurance generating or amplifying systemic risk, but there's a lot of things that insurance groups do these days that you wouldn't describe as being traditional. And so we've focused on areas where, as shown the bottom point there, of non-traditional insurance and non-insurance activities. So one of the big problems with AIG was it wrote hundreds of billions, about $500 billion of credit default swaps, and then it had major calls, collateral calls, liquidity calls on that. It also had, I think, close to $100 billion of securities lending, which it had invested in mortgage-backed securities, a lot of subprime mortgages effectively, and when its counterparties wanted their cash back, they found the cash wasn't available. So that was the the key drivers there are just examples of things that any group could do. In this case, insurance groups could do that created the same sort of systemic problems that the banking system had done. So we took that into account. We published a position paper back in 2011 that sort of laid out, look, this is our view of, there's some things we're not too worried about on the traditional side over here. There's some things we get more worried about on the non-traditional side. For example, financial guarantee insurance was, there's a group of insurers in the US, monoline insurers. They do things like guarantee the loans of cities like Detroit. So Detroit, I think, is now going through an $18 billion default. There will be claims on the insurers there. Most of those insurers are in runoff. Some are in bankruptcy already. So there's quite a lot of evidence that there are things to worry about, and there's the whole area of non-insurance that happens to get done as part of an insurance group. So we've got a considered body of evidence, a conceptual framework that has driven the more detailed work we've been doing. That moves on to how we went about identifying these nine firms. I'll skip through this fairly quickly, but happy to come back and deal with questions either during the session, or I think there's an incentive for me not to talk too long because then more drinks come later on. So we picked up the basic structural approach that the Basel Committee had done, and we thought that was a suitable one to structure what we were doing, but we made clear it was not going to be just picking up their model and applying it, but it's picking up the structure, looking at how we could work that, and we particularly were focusing on the category of non-traditional non-insurance activities, which you'll see later on, we'll put a very high weight on that, whereas the bank, the Basel Committee had five categories, and they just equal weighted those 20% to look at, you know, where they think the concern was most driven. We looked at 50 firms, so we got data. We did this twice. The second time was on the news, so we got data from 50 firms. Generally, large firms in terms of the two groups there, a $60 billion firm with some significant degree of offshore or global activity, or very large firms with any sort of global activity over the $200 billion mark. Plus, we added in some by supervisory judgment, particularly financial guarantee insurers, that asset size weren't all that big. So some of them might have only had $30 or $40 billion in assets, but their off-balance sheet exposures were $500 billion. Some of them up to $1 trillion of what they were covering in credit risk. So we thought they were definitely worthwhile having a good look at. So we did that, and as I said, we were particularly looking at these five categories. Hopefully, you can read the small type there. So I'll work from the bottom up. So size, global activity, substitutability, we gave a 5% weighting to, interconnectedness a 40% weighting, non-traditional non-insurance a 45% weighting. So we tried different weightings, we looked at the impact of these, and we thought, yeah, this is a mixture of science and art. We thought that steers to the right sort of outcome. And the particular indicators we went and collected, I won't go through all of these, these slides will be available, and it's all in the published material that's on our website. So we looked at what can we use as indicators of what's a very complex dynamic, but this is a fairly simple, static set of indicators that we think points us in the right direction. And as you'll see in later slides, we then use the supervisory judgment overlay to say, look, are the numbers pointing us in the right direction? So, for example, variable annuities caught a lot of interest. we're still calling it variable annuities in this slide. In fact, the paper has it as variable products with guarantees. So there's quite a bit of debate about, insurers have written variable annuities for decades, you know, isn't that traditional? Saying, well, no, traditional means you've got the traditional principles of law of large numbers, idiosyncratic risk rather than correlated risk, not related to the economic cycle, whereas the large writers of variable annuities have got complex derivatives programs behind them to manage their risk, which is a very sensible thing to do from a micro prudential perspective, but it really pushes risks out into the system that there's a fair bit of uncertainty of if there is a failure, how is that going to impact on things. So that's one area. Level 3 assets, I must say I wasn't, haven't done my accounting training very much, and when I started finding what accountants have been doing with asset classifications and valuations, it was quite interesting to see that there was an area of potentially difficulty in pricing things, which really did contribute to the lemon problem was one that sort of comes up as a description. So again, I won't go through these indicators here, but they were the ones we used to go through and do the identification process. And these are the steps we used. And the first one sounds really simple, collection of confidential data. That took us about 12 months of discussions with, I spoke to more lawyers that year than I have in any other role I've sort of been in. I had up to 20 lawyers on the phone at one time trying to get agreement across borders and across things of what could be done. But we, in the end, got something agreed between ourselves, the supervisors, the BIS study. It's got special immunity under Swiss law, so we're able to use that as a way of ensuring confidentiality and protection from competitors trying to access information from us. So it was a very interesting process there. We then applied those indicators and the shown before, and we also then had a supervisory judgment process, and this is getting groups of supervisors together for meetings. One meeting went for 14 days non-stop in Basel, locking people away in rooms for a period there. Another one went for 10 days with 45 conference calls, bringing in supervisors for them. So it was a fairly labour-intensive process, but we thought that was necessary to get the analysis done effectively. And then there was a range of challenges. Again, I won't go through those. Most actuaries in the room would be familiar with trying to pull together data from different places, different accounting systems, different jurisdictions, and trying to get some comparability. And insurers really don't have systems that are necessarily well arranged for answering the questions that we'd come up with that never heard of before. So that was an interesting process. As I said, the supervisory judgment process was something that the bankers didn't do, so we created this ourselves. And we think it gave us a lot more confidence that the numbers were steering us in the right direction, but we weren't driven by the numbers. So we had essentially people sitting down, as I said, looking at the numbers, looking at the firms, talking to the firms, talking to the supervisors, and then coming up with, are we satisfied that this is really steering us in the right direction? And then we had a set of principles about what we're trying to get from it, and it was particularly looking at, and this is one thing the insurers found very difficult to accept, that we weren't worried about how likely or not their failure would be. It was if they failed, regardless of likelihood, what would the impact be? And we'd have them come along and want to tell us about how great their risk management system was. They'd send us long documents. They had the best risk management system in the world. And they wouldn't. They have a lot of trouble accepting that we were saying, "Well, every firm can fail. If you fail, what's the impact of it?" That was our key focus in the process, particularly the supervisory judgment. And then, having identified the nine, we've also got a question mark about reinsurers, because the Financial Stability Board has asked us to spend another 6 or 12 months looking at. Reinsurers, so you would have seen there was no reinsurers on that first list, so we're still looking at reinsurers, and we've had conversations with the Global Reinsurance Forum this week about the process, and my team is working on that sort of back in Basel at the moment, and over the next we've got till July next year to finish the work of looking at those, but it's still a key area of interest. So once we have identified them all, we're working on this package of policy measures, which is the GSI package. Now that sits on two things. ComFrame is also being developed, and that's a comprehensive framework that we were already working on for about 50 largest internationally active insurers. And that sits on top of these things called the Insurance Core Principles, which is the basis on which essentially we promote global standards, and all of the jurisdictions around the world are expected to follow those. All the members of the G20 have agreed they will do it, and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank do regular EPSAP's financial sector assessment programs to go and check that APRA is following things, Reserve Bank is following things, and similarly in other countries. So that's the general structure of what we're building. And the purpose of what we're doing on the GSI side is to try to reduce the moral hazard of a failure, and that's much clearer in the banking side, where you essentially would find that banks take on more risk than perhaps they should, because they get the upside of the risk. And then when risk goes really bad, government step in and pile on that. So that's the clearest example, Harrison. AIG provides another example. there, even though there's ongoing litigation from shareholders of ARG that think the US government was unfair in the way they essentially bailed them out and took most of the ownership, but that's up to the US courts to decide. Second point, we'd like these policy measures to reduce the probability and impact of default. And third one, we'd like to provide incentives for the GSIs to become less systemically important. An example of that is ING is going through a process at the moment of splitting its banking insurance business, and that's being driven by European Commission rules. So you'll see there's a number of firms that will choose to change their business models to become less systemically important or to get off the list altogether. And yeah, we're trying to link the policy measures to why the firms were assessed as such. And again, I'll skip through some of these fairly quickly and come back to questions. There's three main groups of policy measures that the FSB has said they want us to do, and that was in that chart before. Enhanced supervision, more effective resolution, and higher loss absorbency, more capital for those that are regarded as G-SIFIs, including the GSIs. We're saying that GSIs tend to be more heterogeneous than the banks, the G-SIF banks, and so we are providing a broader range of policy measures, and then it'll be up to each group-wide supervisor to work out how that should be applied in particular cases. And this is going to require lots of cooperation among authorities within countries and across borders, which is quite a challenge from what I've watched in the time I've been there. Again, I'll skip through these ones fairly quickly. Happy to have questions on them. This is a range of what enhanced supervision might look like. There's a whole work stream under the Financial Stability Board driven by Julie Dixon, who's one of the leaders in the Canadian supervisory world. And there's a particular focus on enhanced liquidity management and planning, which has tended to not be all that high priority within the insurance sector, but we think that needs to be more focus. And then Julie Dixon's group on the supervisory intensity and effectiveness has sort of picked these areas as ones of particular concern, but they've now published three reports with probably 30 or 40 different recommendations that are aimed at getting better supervision for all the big systemically important firms around the world. And it's expected a lot of these will actually apply more broadly to all internationally active groups and probably over time to any important groups within the domestic setting as well. And moving on to the capital side, which goes by the name of HLA, higher loss absorption, and it's primarily expected to be extra capital, but there's some nuances there about exactly how that would apply. As I said, there's a number of steps here. The FSB wants us to initially develop some backstop capital requirements. So the bankers have a 3% leverage ratio. We don't expect we'll have something as simple as that for the insurers because the business is more complex. But we'll have something which is relatively straightforward by late next year. There will be quite a bit of interest in the Basel III rules because particularly the non-insurance activities and even the some non-traditional activities, there are already rules promulgated by Basel III which we think could apply. And there's a strong push to have the non-traditional activity effectively separated from the traditional activity in insurers to help better management. And the current proposal is there should be a lower level of extra capital if insurers can actually separate out those activities. But before we do any of this, we've committed to do impact assessments, and we've got a group that we call the Field Test Task Force that's beaving away and planning for a series of probably biannual field testing over the next 4 or 5 years as part of all the work we're doing in this area. So that's going to be an interesting process, and they are actively canvassing for volunteer firms to sort of join their field testing process. So some of you or your colleagues in firms in this room will be approached or have already been approached to participate in what's a bit of a public good that it will cost everyone involved in the process. We hope we'll get a better set of rules by actually having a close involvement with firms that are going to be subject to those rules. Then moving on to the implementation process, there's a particular thing called the Systemic Risk Management Plan. That gets a lot of questions because the banks don't have anything like that, and they just accept that they will be systemically important and they've always got to put up with it. Whereas quite a number of our supervisors say they don't really want any GSIs in their jurisdiction So if they get any, they want to come up with a plan to help the firms, help inverted commas, stop being classified as such. And for example, in the last one, there might be some restrictions or prohibitions that said, look, you're a GSI because you do these things, we're going to prohibit you from doing them. Some jurisdictions like that, some jurisdictions have the power to do that, either explicit or implicit. Others say, well, no, they firms should be allowed to do that, and you just want to make sure that you then put other measures around them to make it safer for them to do those sort of things. And then the time frames, again, this is all published, so I won't go through it in detail, but you can see there's a 6-year period where we started last month of having the designations. We're coming up with a lot to be done. There's a consultation process now for the next 2 months on the detail of how resolution would work for the GSIs. Then by next year, there's various things the firms have to do. And by the end of next year, we have to have done the first stage of the capital requirements. And then this process sort of goes on, and there's a lot that's not mentioned there. But yeah, it's a big challenge for all the firms, for ourselves, the supervisors. And I've just picked out a couple of things from the consultation documents that were published on Monday by the Financial Stability Board. This is the end of about 2 years' work on resolution. So, for example, they say their recovery plans, and every GSI has to have a recovery plan, should be developed on the basis of severe stress scenarios and combine adverse systemic and idiosyncratic conditions. They need to take into account insurance specificities, such as the longer payout duration liquidity profile of insurers. Now, coincidentally this week, the International Actuarial Association published a paper on stress test and scenario analysis, which I think any actuaries and others involved in helping insurers write these recovery plans would be find time well spent to read that paper and look at how the thinking from the International Actuarial Association could help in design some of these recovery plans. And then on the resolution plans, there's 10 items here over 2 slides. I'm just going to pick on one item in each of them. The one I've highlighted here, you'll see in the second point, that there's a expectation of having independent exit value, actuarial valuation of the technical provisions of all the GSI. So last time I counted, AXA had 6,000 subsidiaries, many of which are insurance subsidiaries. So I'm ensuring assuming that's going to create a fair bit of work for actuaries to go and help AXA to come up with an independent exit value, and we'd certainly like the actuarial profession to perhaps move ahead with getting more standards to help actuaries in getting consistent valuation of technical provisions across the different jurisdictions. That's one example there. Another one here, point 8, is an estimate of the outcome for each class of policyholder upon winding up, and this would then serve as the counterfactual to the resolution plan, because there's a provision in the general approach that if you have these special resolution plans applying, no creditor should be worse off, including policyholders. So to actually assess that, you actually need, well, what's the counterfactual for if you just let the normal approach apply, how would that happen? And so again, it looks like they might need a fair bit of numerical work. Now this is still out for consultation. These requirements may change, but at the moment that is the proposal from the Financial Stability Board as it applies to resolution insurers. Again, this is an obligation for GSIs. It's also expected to apply to many or most internationally active insurance groups over time, but that's still an open question as to whether that happens and when that happens. But also, the FSB is encouraging all jurisdictions to look at just firms, potentially domestically, systemic firms. So there's quite a lot of work there in getting this done. And it starts with 9, but it probably goes to a broader universe over time. And finally, and I will skip through this very quickly because this is more just a heads up for, apart from looking at the firm side, we're looking at the macro prudential surveillance side. We've got a specific group that gets involved in there. We interact with the FSB, with the BIS itself, which does a fair bit of work. In fact, they will say they invented the word macro prudential. The IMF and others of interest. So we've mapped out a plan as to what we intend to do in this area over the next few years, most of which is helping our members develop tools for dealing with this in their own jurisdictions, but also trying to have it aggregated across regions and at the global level. So there's 3 phases there, which is looking at market conditions, financial stability assessment, policy considerations enforcement. Won't go through the detail at the moment. As I said, we've created a group that's focusing on this, and it's complementary to the work we're doing in terms of identifying GSIs. So this is looking at the other side of it. We're looking at the whole markets, the whole systems. And there's one of our insurance core principles, 24, that already puts obligations on supervisors to do this sort of thing. So there's already an obligation under our global rules that this should be done. This is now fleshing out approaches to help all the supervisors and in how this would be done in practice. And we do various surveys and approaches. We've been publishing for a while a global reinsurance market report from last year. It became a global insurance market report on just issues that are of general interest in this area. And we did a bit of survey from our members as to what they're doing in this area. So if you look at the slides there, there's very little agreement on exactly what macroprudential surveillance means at the moment, but that's not surprising. It's a new idea. Most of our members are conducting or plan to conduct some degree of analysis in the insurance market, and that's certainly been an expectation for many years. There's a lot of focus on insurance market-wide stress testing, and we expect there'll be more and more focus on that. And the IMF is certainly keen on pushing that as well. But about 44% are currently conducting that in life and non-life, and another 10 or 20% are planning to do that. This is a little bit dated now, so we're planning to do that over the past 12 months. And there's other types of ad hoc stress testing or more frequent. So there's more and more focus on stress testing as part of the macroprudential side of things. And essentially, and there's, as I said, a 50-page paper that summarises most of this, I won't go through now. There's a whole range of implications there about getting supervisors to look more generally across the whole system, to look at how they can apply the microprudential instruments with a more macroprudential perspective, and also to come up with new instruments. And we've got a group sort of working through that at the moment. The first phase I've gone through this year is just coming up with a particular risk of concern. Low interest rates would rank up there pretty high, but there's a number of others, certainly longevity risk, etc. And this is different in different jurisdictions. And then looking at, are there new instruments that need to be done? And finally, if you want to read more about this, our website, the FSB website's got lots of interesting reading material, and I'm happy to not summarise that, but respond to any questions about what I have covered or what I haven't covered, and still leave time for the social end of the occasion. So thank you.
You mentioned confidentiality. I was just wondering, were there any companies who didn't actually supply with data? Think about in China, like state secrets coming out of companies and that sort of thing. How much of a challenge was that?
It was a challenge. Of the 50 we approached, there was only one that in the end did not provide us with the data, and it was already in bankruptcy proceedings, so we decided that it was no longer worth pursuing that particular company. All the others provided information. They didn't necessarily answer every question, so we were satisfied that we got enough to actually come to conclusions on most of the indicators. There was one indicator we wanted to use, we weren't able to get good enough data for, which was speculative use of derivatives. That wasn't so much an unwillingness to provide, it was more interpreting the questions we'd asked. So we'll have another go next year trying to get better information on that. So in general, the companies were quite cooperative and constructive. We didn't get all the information first up. With some of them, we didn't go through a few iterations of getting their supervisors to encourage them to do that, and we set up mechanisms. If they didn't supply the information we wanted, there was a system that then assessed them based on the highest score for the rest of the firms. So if you didn't provide information, you got assessed as though you had the highest score. So there was an incentive there for them to give some information to avoid being assessed at the in a penal fashion.
Okay. Thank you. And how often will you actually go through the exercise of redetermining the list of the important companies?
It's intended to be an annual process, so we publish these in July. The next intended process will be publication November next year, and that will tie in with the annual publication of the list of globally systemically important banks.
Thanks, John. On the basis that the next crisis is unlikely to be exactly like the last, pandemic. I mean, if one thinks about the most likely thing, and that we've done some work in Australia, wouldn't it make sense that, I mean, that's most likely where insurers would be problematic. Maybe this is covered by your reinsurance analysis, or you've already got done some work on this.
Yeah, that's picked up more in our macroprudential surveillance side, so that's one of the key risks that our group is looking at. And the plans at this stage would be to ensure that stress tests look at suitably severe testing patterns as a potential area that would put stress on firms and systems. So that's what we're looking at the pandemic side.
Because I think in Australia when we did it, there's a government-wide committee to look at the impacts of pandemics. It's much more than financial sectors involved. Is there some international group that does that?
Not that I've seen any activity of in recent times. So we would include that of what we've been reporting up to Financial Stability Board and potential G20, but related to the insurance sector, the financial sector. If it's a broader question, we'd probably need to see a mandate from the G20 leaders that's something they want to focus on. But at the moment, we're really focusing just on the insurance or the financial impact.
Yeah, John, can you just talk a bit more about what you actually mean by the globally systemic insurers? Because does it mean that they're particularly vulnerable, or that their failure would cause ongoing repercussions into the whole financial system? And are they particularly dangerous ones that you've identified, or just ones that you think are particularly high probability of default? Or is it the loss given default that creates the problem?
A bit more definition on what you mean by it.
So essentially it's looking at the ones that would have the biggest impact given default. So and there it's not so much how risky are they, it's if they did fail, what would the impact be? And the FSB's essentially got a definition in its paper that says that would cause disorderly failure of the firm would cause disruption to the broader financial system and to the real economy. That's taken as somewhat of a broader scope of definition that would include if an insurer failed that left a major area of insurance that wasn't replaced in a reasonable time frame. So if you had failures in an area of a specialist insurer, that areas we looked at include provision of credit insurance for supporting global trade or global aviation, those sort of things we've particularly looked at. But it would also be if there's a potential concern that a failure of major variable annuity portfolios put the security of that product type at risk that would lead to potential runs on system, even though the likelihood of runs on insurance groups is lower than banking groups, we certainly don't rule that out as an issue. So it's the ongoing impact on the financial system, on the real economy. We're particularly looking here, it has impact over several different countries, but that could be, given the nature of interconnectedness, that the problem could emerge in one country and sort of flow to others because of the activities those firms have across the borders.
John, how does the list of GSIs correlate with the largest insurers in the world?
There would be a reasonably good correlation there, but certainly not all. There are some large insurers, particularly Japanese insurers, just off the mind. There's no Japanese insurers on that list, whereas Japan has some very large insurers, but they're very much domestically focused. So at the moment, we haven't looked at very large, purely domestic insurers because that hasn't been our remit. We will be looking at that next year in terms of providing some guidance for the national authorities to look at their own firms in terms of domestic significance. But there are some other large global firms that don't feature on the list because they've got a very traditional business base and don't engage in activity. So our approach is essentially screened out domestic players and very traditional players.
John, on the high loss absorbers here, the obvious remedy being capital, which you mentioned, what's the thinking as regards where the capital is positioned? You see it as being something for the group to hold, central capital that's available to deploy flexibly around the group, or do you see that because of the interconnectedness and the contagion risks that you're actually working on getting them to position it all around the individual entities to make them stronger than the competitors locally?
Yeah, it's a mixture of those two. So what we've said in the policy documents is that particularly if the group is going to effectively separate their non-traditional, non-insurance activity to the major driver of systemic risk as we measure it, we're saying the capital should be held in those separated entities so that you actually have them self-sufficient and you also then get the right pricing signals in there. But if they aren't effectively separated or if there isn't appropriate powers to drive it to be held at the entities where the systemic risk is emanating from, we're saying that then it's up to the group-wide supervisor to decide where it would most effectively use, and that can be at the holding company level to be available for the whole group, and that part of the requirement is that all jurisdictions need to have power over the holding companies of the GSIs, and quite a few jurisdictions don't have that at the moment, so that's one of the legislative reforms we would expect need to be put in place in some jurisdictions between now and 2019 so that the supervisor can actually require the capital be held either at holding company level or particular subsidiaries and manage just how that's dealt with over time.
Yeah, excellent. Great answer. I held up the mic because I just had a small, more detailed sort of rider on that, which is that if you look at interconnectedness and measure it by balance sheet measures, then there might be some sort of counterintuitive signals coming out of it, in the sense that if you look at reinsurance groups, if you add in, or into any reinsurance arrangement, if you add something like a funds withheld or a collateralization arrangement, you'll actually find a bigger intermediation between the balance sheets, which looks like the connectedness, but actually strengthens the subsidiary and creates the sort of firewall between the two entities. So I guess you're working through detail as you go.
Yeah, on the intergroup connectedness within groups, we essentially are looking at the consolidated position. So we net out any intra-group, and we do look at them in relation to measures of complexity, but in terms of the starting point is essentially looking at the whole group. We don't ignore them, so there is a... That does flow through in terms of something measured, but in terms of we then separately look at what's the interconnectedness of the group with other parts of the financial sector. So there's two different things we're looking at there.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, John, for that presentation. I found it really interesting. I've got two questions. One is, with the sort of 9 globally systemically important insurers, many to us spotted that Neuro General Insurance were Allianz and AIG, but there might be more that write general insurance, obviously, like AXA, like Saxa write general insurance somewhere, even though they don't write it in Australia. I wasn't sure, but it seems that they mostly life insurers, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, and a lot of that comes from the particular areas we're focused on capital markets activities, which tends to be more coming off the balance sheets of the life insurers and the composites than from the non-life side. So we certainly looked at quite a number of non-life insurers, but on the indicators we're using, they tend to score less highly than the life insurers because their business tends to be more short-term, more idiosyncratic. There's certain issues about those that could lead them up there, but the key drivers what we look at were more the capital markets activities and more activities that life insurers and composites certainly get more involved in.
The other, it's more a comment, I suppose, is that I noticed when you mentioned that, you know, banks kind of do these risky things and the government's going to bail them out in the end if things go wrong. I could just see some similarities between that and general insurance, where you have flood insurance, where some homes are very exposed to floods, therefore that
the proper risk rated flood insurance premium for them is huge, and they might choose not to buy that because they know the government's going to bail them out in the end if the flood does come. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
That's an interesting one. We probably look at that quite a bit in terms of what evidence is there for systemic risk from what's happened in the past. And so one that comes up is after 9/11, you had the removal of terrorism insurance availability.
Mm-hmm.
And so the debate there is, was that a systemic impact?
Mm-hmm.
Or was that a market failure? Or was it essentially a repricing of the risk that had obviously changed dramatically overnight?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easy to come down clean on one side or the other. It's certainly, if suddenly insurance capacity is removed, for whatever reason, you have disruptions to the businesses that are relying on it, to the real economy, and then how do you view that and sort of deal with that? So there's, and I think the flood insurance side is partly there. That's quite often government social policy of just how willing are they for people to build houses in flood zones for whatever reasons. And so there's some of the areas are more a mixture of social policy and just what's the inherent situation. Earthquake insurance is certainly another part of that. We didn't need to sort of come to firm conclusions ourselves in that regard, but the potential, and HIH come up quite often in discussion, was the failure of HIH in Australia a systemic event? We still have different views than that around our membership. I think, I'm probably coming from Australia and seeing the involvement there and the impacts on things there, I would say, to my mind, it certainly was an example of a domestic systemic impact, probably not global, even though it certainly was operating outside Australia, New Zealand, other countries. So there's far fewer examples to look at on the insurance side than the banking side, but we think there's enough there that says that it's not an issue you can ignore, and particularly if the banking supervisors are more successful in making the banking system safer, it's likely that risk is going to move somewhere else. That might not move the insurance sector, but it might. And so our job is to help protect it if it potentially does. Well, it looks like we might have come to that stage of the proceedings where I can thank you for having come along for raising the question. Melinda had to run off to dinner, so I think that leaves us to Lisa and or Sarah to point to where the drinks and nibblies might be outside. And once again, thank you there. I think there will be material on the website if you wish to revisit anyone's there, and I'm happy to pull up any particular questions later on. So thank you all for coming on.